Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the show, and welcome to the beginning of the Light and the Dark tour. As I record this, I'm about 2 days away from the Mothman Festival. So as you're listening to this, I am en route to Point Pleasant, West Virginia. I can't tell you how excited I am. I have not been to Point Pleasant, not when I was writing the Mothman Prophecies and not since then. This is going to be a first. So some of you I know are going to be there, and please do not hesitate to come up and say hi. Anyone who's at the Mothman Festival, please feel free. Visit me at the booth or wherever you see me. And for the rest of you, if you can make it out to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, do it. The Washington, D.C. show with Scott Philbrook is sold out. Thank you guys so much. And now we're looking at Heart Bar in Brooklyn. And the home of Leo and Janice Bartoldis in Center Reach, Long Island, where they host their Haunted Hallways, Haunted House. I can't wait for these shows. Guys, if you can get out to it, please do check out Eventbrite and type in my name. You'll find tickets to the shows. I would so love to see you guys. This is, I'm very excited. This is about to happen. Okay, a couple more pieces of housekeeping before we start the show. Friend of the show, Dan Zetterstrom, he is starting his own podcast. And Dan, if you remember, is the guy, he and his girlfriend, Elena, went to visit Michael Chapman, who is the healer that we talked about at the end of the episode, Surgeon from Another World. And they visited him in Wales, in England, and they got healed, which is absolutely amazing. So he is now starting his own podcast called What It Means to Be Human. And he's a wonderful guy. This sounds like an amazing podcast. I think the best way to find it right now, because it's brand new, is to go to his website, check it out. What It Means to Be Human. We'll have a link in the show notes. But if you go to the website, just, you know, whatitmeanstobehuman.com, you'll find him there. The podcast is exactly what you would think it is about. It is a deep dive into the mysteries of consciousness, humanity, and the anomalous. And Dan is just such an interesting guy. He's got a lot of stories to tell. I would check this one out. I'm going to be listening. There's already one episode out. I haven't listened to it yet. I'm going to. You guys check it out. And you might even hear me on one of those episodes. I don't know. And then finally, you know what? I got an email from you guys. I had mentioned on Astonishing Legends that I'm still at a place where I can read the emails that you guys send me through the website, through my website. And I got this one. I wanted to read it to you guys. This one really touched me. I reached out to the author of this letter, and he hasn't written back yet. So I'm going to read his letter anyway. I'm just not going to mention his name. But I thought this was pretty great. He says, "Hi, Rich. I'm a fan of your new show, a huge fan of your new show. I just turned 40. I live in Phoenix, Arizona, and I grew up with an unusual pull towards anything spooky or supernatural. My favorite holiday as a young kid was Halloween. I can remember being a sophomore in high school when Mothman came out. It was weird and dark, and I didn't really understand it, but I knew I loved it. I had no idea who wrote it, of course. Then as an adult, I started listening to Astonishing Legends. I remember some late night drives to Tucson for work, driving across the dark and empty desert, listening to the Astonishing Legends episode about Mothman. It was one of their best episodes for me because I didn't know how weird the real events were that John Keel experienced. Then my favorite episodes became the ones you did as a guest appearance, and ultimately, the episodes of Astonishing Legends I looked forward to the most were the Christmas party episodes every year. I would save it for Christmas Eve, put my kids to bed, my wife and I would put all the presents under the tree, and then she would go to bed, but not me. I would stay up for a couple of hours, savoring the anticipation of Christmas, and I would listen to the Astonishing Legends Christmas episode. I actually plan it out and rehearse it in my head in the weeks leading up to Christmas. And then a day or two before, I would go to Total Wine and I'd get a special beer, usually Bat Squatch, and a few ingredients that I would need for whatever cocktail I was planning on making. I never made anything as unique as you do, but one year it was an Old Fashioned and another year it was a White Russian. Then after everyone was in bed, I would put my earbuds in and sit at the bar next to the Christmas tree and the fireplace and have a couple of drinks and listen to the episode. There is some kind of ethereal feel on the night before Christmas. These past couple of years, I have struggled a lot in my marriage, and it's just about on its last leg. Your new show has quickly become my new favorite podcast. Its twin parts of Your Life and The Book Breakdowns are both equally interesting to me. I still love the paranormal, and I'm also going through some of the toughest moments of my personal life. I have two boys, 5 and 3, which I believe is the same age as your boys when you got divorced. Those episodes are hard to listen to, but at the same time, I can't turn them off. In fact, I've listened to some of them multiple times. Please keep making your show. It means a lot to some of us out here, and it gives us hope to hear about the things you went through and how you came out of them. To the author of this letter, I want to say, first of all, thank you so much for sharing all of this. I just love this letter. I love picturing you on Christmas Eve, listening to the Astonishing Legends Christmas episode and getting your drink ready. And I also just want to say, I know what you're going through. And that's why I do the show, because things can be dark, but I do believe there is always a light in the dark. And I hope you continue listening and you get something from the episodes and you find your way through the dark and get to a better place. Okay. Guys, I hope I see you at one of the shows. And if not on this leg of the tour, on an upcoming leg, there will be more live performances. And now let's get on with the show. I'm on the road. You guys are about to hit the road with the National Directory of Haunted Places. Here we go. The National Directory of Haunted Places by Dennis William Houck, Part 1. Here's an entry from page 1 of Dennis William Houck's National Directory of Haunted Places, Athenor Press, Sacramento, 1994. The state listed at the top of page 1 is Alabama, of course, because we're going alphabetically. The city is Bladen Springs, and the place is Bladen Springs Cemetery. Here's the entry.
The ghost of Captain Norman Staples has been reported hovering over the graves of his 4 children, James Alfred, Berth Jedetta, Mabel Claire, and an unnamed baby. His apparition seems to be protecting the grave, although the captain is sometimes seen with his hands pressed against his head, as if he is suffering from great anguish or regret.
Protecting his children and grieving them. It's what us dads do every day. Protecting your kids, sure, you say, but grieving them? Yeah, we do that too. Because, as every parent knows, you start to lose your kids the day you have them. Do we find out the story of what happened to Captain Norman Staples in the National Directory of Haunted Places? No. But we do get an address. You think I'm kidding? Mr. Houck gives you turn-by-turn instructions on exactly how to get to the cemetery. Listen to this.
Follow Highway 84 east from the town of Bladen Springs for 5 miles. About a half mile after the bridge in the road, turn right onto County Road 6 and follow it for 3 miles. The cemetery is on Road 6.
Here's another one. 392 pages later, the last page. In Powell, Wyoming, Northwest Community College. Here's the entry.
Strange things have been reported in the auditorium of this college since the 1970s. Mysterious cold spots hover in the middle of the stage, and during performances, an invisible presence occupies a front row seat, third from the left in the middle section. During one rehearsal, a sinister black cloud formed over seats in the left rear of the auditorium. Odd noises, objects moving by themselves, and lighting controls overridden by ghosts are just a few of the weird things that go on. A student writing jokes on the blackboard in the green room turned around to see the apparition of a woman smiling at him.
Then it goes on to give the exact location of the college and a phone number. Finding the National Directory of Haunted Places felt like finding a magical treasure map when I came across it at Nicholas Potter Books in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in September of 1995. At the time, there simply wasn't anything like it. There were local guides, sure, if you happened to be in Savannah, Georgia, or Topeka, Kansas, you might find a book about their haunted hotspots in some little bookstore, but you already had to be there to find it. With this book, you could suss out every corner of every state in advance and then book your entire trip around visiting these haunted tourist spots. Cities I previously had no interest in ever visiting suddenly leapt up as dream destinations, places I would fantasize about. One day, swear to God, I'm going to go to Butte, Montana and check out the Mount Moriah Cemetery and see if I can see the ghost of the old guy in the wheelchair. I don't know why I talk like that in my fantasies, but I do. Now, there was a lot happening for me in the fall of 1995, and it was all happening fast. Under Siege 2, Dark Territory, had come out in July. I was now an actual produced writer. I had an agent, David Saunders, at APA. I was putting the finishing touches on what I felt was the first really good script I'd ever written on my own, a thriller called Truth or Consequences. Now, by the way, this has nothing to do with the Kiefer Sutherland film. That's just a coincidence. I was finally cutting myself a little slack. I felt like I was on the verge of being a legitimate human being on planet Earth for the first time ever. Like, I actually deserved to be here and breathe the air. I wasn't drenched in shame all the time, the way I had been for most of my adult life. I wasn't just some deluded idiot who wanted a career in Hollywood. Now I kind of had one. A world of possibilities were opening up. Now, all I needed was money. See, the sale of Dark Territory had been 2.5 years ago, and there'd been nothing since. I was still working lunches at Tony Roma's in Pasadena. I felt rich, but I was cash poor, which for me is a dangerous place. I've had a lifelong habit of spending tomorrow's money today, even when tomorrow never actually comes through with its part of the bargain. Some people said that my belief that I would one day succeed in Hollywood was somehow connected to my belief in the paranormal, and that they were both equally irrational. Believing in something isn't enough, they'd say. You need proof. So very early on, I tried for proof. When I was a junior in high school in 1983, I wrote my first script, an episode of the TV show, The A-Team, and I had every intention of selling it. The A-Team had been created by Stephen J. Cannell, the same guy who created my other favorite show, The Rockford Files. He was my hero. The whole reason I was a writer, and I was desperate for Stephen J. Cannell himself to read my script. After failing to get an agent to submit it for me, I came up with a truly insane, you might say irrational plan for my friend Larry and I to deliver my script directly into his hands at his offices in Hollywood. And if you want to hear that story, check out season 2, episodes 7 and 8, The Other Side, part 1 and 2. Okay, ultimately the plan didn't work. But I kept on writing, year after year, script after script, until finally, Matt Reeves, my best friend from USC Film School, and I sold our action movie, Dark Territory, and it got made into the sequel to the Steven Seagal movie, Under Siege. Under Siege 2, Dark Territory felt like proof, finally, or at least strong evidence. I was on the verge of a breakthrough. I knew it. I just had to keep going. Now, of course, I needed to prove that it wasn't just because of Matt Reeves that Dark Territory sold and got made. I needed to sell something on my own. That would be conclusive proof. This mandate hung over me, pacing back and forth like an ominous ghost. It haunted me. Michelle's parents had treated us to a long weekend in Santa Fe as a gift for our third wedding anniversary. It was an incredibly generous gift, but there was an ulterior motive. It is a well-known fact that many young couples conceive while on vacation. That's why we have so many Dakotas and Siennas and Las Vegases running around. I'd spent the day wandering through the Nicholas Potter bookstore, and now we were having dinner at Santa Cafe, staring at the flickering candle on our table, sipping the last of our margaritas, and dreaming of a future that finally felt like it was coming into focus. As we left the restaurant, the temperature dropped, a cold wind kicked up, and suddenly it was pouring rain. By the time we got back to our room at the Water Street Inn, we were soaked to the skin, but deliriously happy in the way that only people from Los Angeles can be while enjoying the dramatic weather of some other region. We pulled off our wet clothes, still damp and half drunk and laughing, and stumbled our way through the dark to our bed. Later that night, as she lay asleep next to me, I sat up with all the windows open, the wind blowing through the room and the storm raging outside. And I opened up the National Directory of Haunted Places and roamed through its pages and began to dream of the future I had always wanted.
Alto Street, Santa Fe, New Mexico. The Phantom of the Headless Caballero haunts this street. The hapless cowboy brandishes a sword as he rides his horse down the road to the Santa Fe River. It is said that he lost his head to two Spanish witches after complaining about a love potion they gave him that had gone terribly wrong. The Phantom has been seen on Alto Street and along the riverbank ever since.
It was 1 month later, on November 1st, the day before my 29th birthday, that we found out Michelle was pregnant with our first child. She was late on her period and was so nauseous she thought she had the stomach flu. She went to her doctor and they gave her a test and she found out, and then she came home and told me. I was happy on the outside, but on the inside I was feeling something else. If I could have put the feeling into words, it would have been something like, I'm going to be a father, and a father is supposed to have a career. In my mind, the worst thing you could ever do was have a baby before you had a solid career. You're talking to a guy who expected to make his first sale before he graduated high school. It was now 12 years later, and I still hadn't made a sale on my own. The next day when we told her mom, she must have read my mind because she hugged me and said, "Don't worry, a baby brings its own basket." Could that be true? I wasn't sure. It seemed like in the history of the world, there must have been at least a few times when a baby arrived without a basket. But I hoped she was right. Truth or Consequences would be going out to buyers in about a week. And my agent, David Saunders, had assured me it was going to sell. The only question now was for how much. So maybe the timing was perfect. Maybe this was all meant to be. Truth or Consequences went out for a weekend read to every studio in town on Friday, November 10th, and I felt very good about its chances. But 3 days later, it was all over. It didn't sell at any price to anyone. I took this development in stride, curling up on the floor of my office, shivering and crying, and staring at the dust motes beneath my desk and spiraling down into my shame hole. My first big solo effort had failed. I wasn't good enough to make it on my own. Matt was currently doing post-production on his first feature film, The Pallbearer, co-starring Gwyneth Paltrow and the hot young star of television's biggest new hit show, Friends, David Schwimmer. Matt's career was going great. He was doing fine without me, but me without him? Not so much. It was a crushing, humiliating failure, and it fed into all my worst fears about myself and my lack of talent. This was not a new feeling, of course. It was very familiar, and it was the worst feeling in the world. But now, it was just a little bit worse, because now it came with something new. A ticking sound. That sound was the clock inside Michelle's uterus, also known as a baby. The due date was July 14th, exactly 8 months away. Tick, tick, tick. I felt weak and hollowed out. I wanted to lie on the floor of my office for the rest of my life. But I couldn't, because now I had 8 months to do what I hadn't managed to do in the last 12 years. I sat up and pulled the National Directory of Haunted Places down off my desk and started flipping through it. I wasn't daydreaming this time. I was just stalling. Visiting haunted locations is for closers, I thought. Whatever rewards the book had to offer, they were going to have to be earned.
Chicago, Illinois. Red Lion Pub. A doorway to the unknown was opened in this 1882 building when John Cordwell decided to turn the three-story brick structure into a quaint English pub. As part of his renovation, Cordwell installed a stained glass window over the stairway and added a brass plaque honoring his father, who had been buried in England without a tombstone. Before long, people passing the window were overcome with an unexplainable dizziness, and John sensed the presence of his father's spirit on the second floor. A half dozen others seemed to have accompanied his father. The strong smell of lavender signals the presence of a 20-year-old girl who died in the building. The upstairs ladies' room is haunted by a strange force that traps women inside. The apparition of a man sometimes walks through the bar and up the stairs, and the ghost of an unshaven young man wearing cowboy boots is seen in the upstairs bar. A woman in a 1920s outfit, a blonde-haired man with a broad face, and a bearded man wearing a black hat also haunt the tavern.
I spent Christmas that year surrounded by family and friends who were all excited for Michelle and I and the coming baby. Everyone kept telling me that my life was going to change. 1996 is going to be a big year. They were obviously right. But after all, Michelle was doing the real work of being pregnant. My part in that process had been fairly simple, if magnificent. It was time for me to find my ass a job. Writing a whole new script wasn't going to happen. I had no energy and no ideas. Writing Truth or Consequences had drained me. And David Saunders assured me that writing a new original script wasn't even necessary. Even though Truth or Consequences hadn't sold, people had really liked it. The idea was that someone who liked my script would hire me to write something they already had in development. A book adaptation, a rewrite, something. My first meeting of 1996 happened on January 8th, and it was unlike any meeting I'd ever had up until then. My agent told me I didn't have to prepare anything. In this meeting, they were trying to sell me. Well, well, well. Show up and do nothing but look pretty? I'm in. The meeting was with two producers, Ben Myron and Ted Ravenette. They had the rights to a book by Tom Brown Jr. called The Tracker, Berkeley Books, 1986. It's an autobiographical story about a young boy who learns how to survive in the New Jersey Pine Barrens from an Apache elder named Stalking Wolf. It's a great book, bordering on the totally unbelievable. In other words, I loved it. Ben and Ted wanted to turn this book into a movie franchise, a sort of James Bond of the wilderness. Now look, my idea of surviving the outdoors is navigating my way from valet parking to an air-conditioned restaurant. But they didn't know that. I left the meeting with a copy of the book and a feeling of near elation. Every other time I had started a project, it was from the absolute bottom of the mountain. I had to crawl up every inch alone, hoping that somewhere along the way, someone would appear to make the climb easier. A friend would have a kind word about my outline, or an idea to help me get past a rough spot in the plot. And even then, when I'd finally finish a draft, who was I supposed to show it to? How could I get it made? Who would care about it as much as I did? Well, none of that applied to the tracker. I would be writing it for Ben and Ted, who were actual producers, who already loved the project even more than I did. And they had a first look deal with Mike Medavoy's Phoenix Pictures, which at the time had a deal with Fox Studios. I felt like I was starting halfway up the mountain with a full team of climbers and maybe even a few donkeys to carry the heavy stuff. I started working out the story. The idea was to have just enough figured out to make an exciting 20-minute pitch. The process was like this. I'd work for a few days, and then I'd send Ben and Ted whatever I had for them to review. Now, this was scary because it didn't give me a lot of time to really sit with stuff and work it through a million times and fall in love. Every time I sent them something, I was convinced they'd realize that my work was shit. They never did. They loved it. This put me into a weird place. Their love for my work made me lose respect for them. It made me not trust them. But another part of me started thinking, hey, maybe it's fine. Maybe they're seeing something I'm not. After all, they're big Hollywood producers. If they're happy, why fight it? You don't have to personally fall in love with every single movie you write. Don't forget that. That hasn't exactly worked for you so far. So I just kept working with a sick, dizzy feeling that I was losing my way on this climb up the mountain. But every time I thought I was hopelessly lost, Ben and Ted would emerge from the fog on a snowy peak, smiling and waving and beckoning me forward. By late February, I had the full pitch written. Now, the night before the pitch to Phoenix Pictures, I did a practice run for Michelle. When I was finished, she said, "That was really good." But I detected a note of underwhelmedness. So I pressed her until she said, "I think it's great. It definitely sounds like a movie. It just doesn't sound like you." I felt the mountain tremble, and I heard the sound of snow dislodging from somewhere high above me. "Well, that's the whole point," I said. I'm writing this for them, not me. I mean, I have to be able to write things on assignment that aren't my dream projects. That's what it means to be a professional screenwriter." She totally got it and agreed and didn't seem upset. But now I was upset. I felt exposed because I knew deep down she was right. I'd been feeling it since the beginning. Tracker wasn't me. But did that matter? Truth or Consequences was definitely me. And Truth or Consequences hadn't sold. Was personal sincerity required for a script to be good? It couldn't be. I saw the movies that were getting made. And besides, most scripts got rewritten multiple times by multiple writers before a studio decided to film them anyway. Sincerity obviously didn't matter. And at no point had Ben or Ted even come close to suggesting I should put more of myself into the pitch I was writing. No, what I was doing had to be good enough. They liked it. They had liked it enough to set up a pitch at Phoenix Pictures. Don't freak yourself out. Don't sabotage yourself. You're almost at the top of the mountain. Just keep going. And don't look down.
Sonoyta, Arizona. Lost Trail Hotel. The severed head of a screaming woman was once seen floating high in the corner of a room here. The glowing head had long dark hair and bright red lipstick and continued to scream, even as it faded from view. The ghost appeared in 1976 to a couple from Sonoyta, but no one has ever been able to explain it.
The next day at the pitch, I was surprised when Mike Medavoy himself walked into the room. Usually the top people don't attend pitches. They just wait to get filled in later by their staff. Maybe this was a good sign. I was excited. I could feel myself getting into the zone. And I was no longer worried about the pitch not sounding like me. The meanness of the pitch would come through because, after all, I was the one pitching it. Now, before the hammer falls on this story, as you and I know it must, Let me say at least this. I pitched the living hell out of Tracker that day. I gave it my all. I put my heart into every word. I really, truly did. Mike Medavoy didn't dislike the pitch. He hated it. It was like I had ruined his entire week, like the pitch was something I vomited into his lap. The really surprising part was the lengths he went to, right there in the room, to express his disappointment. I was so shocked, it took a while to sink in that I wasn't going to be selling anything today. Just so you know, this never happens. The only thing rarer than a yes in the room is an I hate this and I hate you in the room. In Hollywood, you can die from encouragement. No one ever tells you they don't like your work. They tell you they love your work. But unfortunately, they just bought something exactly like it last week. Or the decision wasn't up to them. But if it had been, they would have bought your project in a heartbeat. But what they never tell you, if they really don't like it, is that they really don't like it. So, score some truth points for Medavoy. He went on and on until I suspected it was more about chastising his development team than me, which really seemed unfair because they had all been really nice and extremely helpful. At some point, he just got up and left. Then I got even more awkward in the room as the development team all tried to spin what had just happened as not as bad as it seemed. After a decent interval, Ben, Ted, and I thanked everyone, and we all promised to circle back and figure out a reapproach, and we left. Now, usually the rule is you don't talk about the meeting until you've left the building. But as soon as we got in the elevator, Ben started to apologize to me profusely for Mike Medavoy's behavior. He must have gotten some bad news on another project. We just got fucked on timing, he said. But of course, none of this was Ben's fault, and he didn't owe me an apology. It wasn't even Mike Medavoy's fault, not really. Maybe sincere or not, the pitch just wasn't very good. By now, my gyroscope was completely off. I had no idea where I was or how to proceed. Mike Medavoy was the avalanche, and I was buried in snow. When I got home, there was a stack of mail in the mailbox, most of which went directly into recycling. The only important letters were from Chase Manhattan Bank and Visa, two of my half dozen credit cards that were hovering just beneath their limit. The minimum balances seemed even higher than usual, and my mood was bad enough for me to haul out my thick file of credit card bills and all my various checkbooks and really figure out what was what. I had assumed we were about $20,000 in debt, an appalling sum, but one that a single sale or script assignment could erase in an instant. But when I totaled up the actual number, I was shocked to see it was actually just over $50,000. $50,000 in credit card debt. How could this have possibly happened? It had started just after the sale of Dark Territory almost 3 years ago. I truly felt that my next big sale was always just a week or so away. But that had been over 150 weeks ago, and the sales had not come. And the Tracker pitch was clearly not going to be the solution I was hoping for. I was currently working 5 shifts a week at Tony Roma's, and that barely added up to grocery money. Michelle worked at a place called Historic Resources Group in Hollywood. She didn't make a ton of money, but it was more than I made. It was regular, and it covered our rent, which was now almost twice what it was a few weeks ago because we had just moved to a bigger place since there would be a baby soon, and since I was obviously on my way to a real paycheck, what with this awesome Tracker pitch. Okay, don't panic. You can always borrow some more money from Dad if you have to. And the credit card people aren't going to come to your house and start hauling away your belongings. They like it when you're in debt up to your gills. All you got to do is make sure you make the monthly minimum payments. You just got to make it another month. You just got to make it until something good happens. I totaled up the minimum balances we owed in the next 30 days across a total of 7 credit cards. It was just over $1,900. Then I checked our bank account. Just under $300. Even with Michelle's paychecks and whatever I'd pull in slinging ribs, I just didn't see how we were going to make it past the middle of March. But of course, in the back of my mind, I already knew exactly what I was going to do. I walked over to the recycling bin and pulled out one of the letters I had dumped. It was from Bank of America, offering me an incredibly low interest rate of 0% for the first year if I transferred a balance over $5,000. Plus, I'd get access to $2,500 in cash advances at their normal interest rate. I felt better. See, there's always a solution if you're just willing to see it as a solution.
West Palm Beach, Florida. Burger King. The ghost of a young man has appeared to several employees here. Janitor Herman Herrera chased the phantom through the restaurant, only to see it disappear before his eyes. When he saw the ghost a second time, he quit his job. A night manager encountered the apparition on his shift in 1993. Two assistant managers have also seen the apparition.
I used to obsessively peruse travel guides. Now it was just the National Directory of Haunted Places. I mean, isn't this what I really wanted from travel? To go to another world, a different reality. I wanted magic to be an active controlling force in my life. I wanted people and projects to appear out of nowhere suddenly and change the course of my life forever. I wanted to have the money to travel to strange cities and sit at the bar in the lobby of an old hotel and watch the lamps flicker and see the bottles move by themselves on glass shelves against dark mirrors. Somehow in my mind, none of this was scary or sinister. In these fantasies, the ghosts are all on my side. Every state, every city, every small town seems to glow with proof that the world isn't just a harsh, unforgiving, zero-sum landscape of rocks and dirt and air and buildings and credit card bills. It's something so much more. It's a land where dreams can come true.
Conyers, Georgia, Fowler Farmhouse. On the 13th day of each month, the Virgin Mary is said to visit a simple farmhouse just outside Conyers. Nancy Fowler first saw visions of Mary and Jesus in 1988, and today she announces the visitations to her thousands of faithful pilgrims who come to her farm. Sometimes the crowds swell to nearly 60,000 people, many of whom share in the miraculous visions.
On Tuesday, March 12th, I got home from my lunch shift at Tony Roma's to see my phone answering machine blinking with 5 messages. The hell? Now, I don't remember what the first 4 were, but the 5th one was my agent asking me to call him back. So I did. David was very excited. He'd set a meeting for me with a producer named Neil Nordlinger, who had just signed a first-look feature development deal with Warner Brothers. Neil was a really sweet, smart guy with tons of enthusiasm and ideas. Just a really solid, nice guy. At the meeting, he pitched me an idea called Quentin's Loose. Here's the idea. A massive earthquake hits San Francisco, resulting in the destruction of San Quentin State Prison, where 100 of the most dangerous inmates escape and make their way to San Francisco. But once our main bad guy gets there, he finds himself hunted by the very same cop who put him away in the first place. And now they engage in a cat and mouse battle across the ruined landscape of the city by the bay. That was it. That was the idea. It wasn't much, but it sounded big. It sounded like the kind of movies that were getting made in the mid-90s. But even better, it sounded mythological in its central conflict, a true battle between good and evil against a familiar but transformed backdrop. It already felt like me more than Tracker did. In my mind, I made a plan. I was going to write a pitch and sell it and sign a contract to write Quentin's Loose, and I was going to get it all done in 6 weeks. I chose May 1st as my drop-dead date because Michelle and I had to fly to Ann Arbor, Michigan that day to attend her sister's law school graduation from the University of Michigan. The whole family was going, and once again, they were going to pay for it. But it was my secret dream to announce to them that they wouldn't have to, because I had finally gotten an assignment and would be able to pay for the trip on my own. Michelle was visibly pregnant now, well into her second trimester, and I was feeling worse and worse each day about my prospects as a dad. If anyone had asked, I would have told them that my life's goal was to be a completely different parent than my own mom or dad. And yet, this overwhelming urge to have a career before the baby was born felt like it came from my father. It felt genetic, hardwired into my DNA like an animal gathering acorns for the winter. Was it a human thing? Or was I actually turning into my own dad, focusing on money to avoid more complicated emotions? Either way, it really didn't matter. I needed money regardless. The only way we were going to get out of our debt hole was for me to get a job. So I focused on that. I worked on Quentin's Loose. And in the course of a week, I came up with some cool ideas. The inmates would be led by a super violent, super genius criminal. And you know what? The guy was on death row. And you know what? He was being marched to the gas chamber when the earthquake hit, and he takes it as a sign from God that he was set free. But what he doesn't count on once he gets to San Francisco is that he's going to have to deal with the cop who put him away in the first place. And you know who that cop is? Only the most famous, badass cop San Francisco's ever had. Dirty Harry. That's right. My idea was that this would be the last biggest Dirty Harry movie ever. The whole thing becomes a final epic battle between two mythic figures amidst the ruin and rubble of a post-earthquake San Francisco. Neil Nordlinger's deal was at Warner Brothers, and Clint Eastwood's company, Malpaso Productions, had their deal at Warner Brothers too. Neil loved this idea. He said he'd heard that Clint was open to the idea of doing another Dirty Harry movie and that Warner Brothers would flip over the idea that he'd go out in a big action flick, not just a typical cop drama. So I worked on this until mid-April. When I finally pitched it to Neil, he was so excited he set a meeting for me to pitch it to Warner Brothers the following week. Neil really loved it. But then Ben and Ted had really loved Tracker. I pitched Quentin's Loose, a.k.a. Dirty Harry 6, to the vice president of feature film development at Warner Brothers on Tuesday, April 23rd. And I was a little surprised to be pitching to someone so high up in the organization, but because it concerned one of their major stars and major franchises, I guess it made sense. The pitch went as well as any pitch could. But I was starting to learn that that didn't mean much. I will say this. She didn't spend 10 minutes berating her staff for even bringing me in, so that was nice. Later that afternoon, my agent reported back telling me that she loved the pitch and was taking it upstairs, which meant she had to sell it to her boss, but hey, that's how these things get done. I was hoping against hope that I would have an answer by Friday, but I didn't. So I sweated out the weekend. Monday came and went. No answer. I knew that every day I didn't hear something, the chances of hearing something good went down.
San Diego, Arroyo abduction. On June 19th, 1991, Laura Arroyo was abducted from her home and murdered. The 9-year-old's body was found in an industrial area of Chula Vista, about 4 miles from her home. In early July, Laura's image started appearing on a blank billboard at night. Her face seemed to be looking up into the sky. The image appeared after sunset, when the sign's lights were turned on. Some said her killer's face was also visible on the billboard to the right and behind Laura's face. Luis Arroyo and his two sons identified the image as that of his daughter. On July 18th, an estimated crowd of 20,000 people showed up at the billboard and caused a huge traffic jam. On July 25th, the billboard company turned off the lights to the sign, but local residents quickly reconnected them. The billboard is located 2 miles from Laura Arroyo's home in San Diego and 2 miles from the spot where her body was found in Chula Vista.
I sit at home all day on April 30th, waiting for David Saunders to call. I need to hear something today. I need to hear good news now. I'm daring the phone to ring. I'm begging it to ring. But I'm too proud to pick it up and call him. If my magical arbitrary drop-dead date for getting work means anything at all, it'll happen without my help. It'll just happen. He finally calls at 6:30 p.m. Warner Brothers is passing. After dinner, Michelle and I pack our bags for our trip back east. I'm numb, in a fog. It'll be the last time packing for a trip will be easy for us. The next time, there will be a baby. The next day on the plane, I'm leaning heavily into vodka and cranberry cocktails. I'm still feeling the body blow of failure, but I'm relieved to be leaving Los Angeles. It feels like an escape. I won't have to face the shame of the barren landscape of my career for at least a week. We've built in a little side trip to visit our friends, Claudia and Lee, in Washington, D.C. first. Claudia's pregnant too, due almost the same week as Michelle. We'll stay at Claudia and Lee's house in D.C. for a few days, and then we'll fly from there to Michigan. I checked my new credit card before we left. We have $3,000, so we're fine. I take the National Directory of Haunted Places out of my bag and look at Washington, D.C. Every square inch is haunted by someone or something. Claudia and Lee live in McLean, Virginia, a suburb of D.C., and Virginia is plenty haunted too. Good. I want to be somewhere so haunted, so saturated in magic, that I can believe for a little while longer that my life is enchanted and the impossible can still happen.
Vidalia, Mississippi, Old Vidalia Jail. The ghost of a woman dressed in a red gown with a flaring bustle is seen in a particular jail cell here, when it is otherwise unoccupied. She is thought to be the ghost of Rose Mataz, an immoral and flamboyant young woman known as the Hungarian Razmataz. She spent time in the jail cell in 1879 for attempted robbery. Some say the devil sentenced her to eternity in the old jail cell. Others say she is just seeking a little peace and quiet. Jailers and visitors have reported her apparition standing in a corner of the cell, defiantly humming a tune and cleaning her long fingernails.
On our first night with Claudia and Lee, they take us out to dinner at L'Auberge Chez Francois, a French restaurant in an old country farmhouse in the green rolling hills of Great Falls, Virginia. As we sit down, the waiter informs us the current Republican presidential nominee, Bob Dole, is seated in just the next room. Politics aside, I'm excited. This was back when the phrase and the idea of politics aside was still actually possible. We order drinks. Well, Lee and I do. Michelle and Claudia are pregnant. I won't be paying tonight, so I relax a little and decide to indulge. I have the house aperitif, champagne with raspberry liqueur. Lee has a Fisher LaBelle with orange bitters. Then, for the next 3 hours, we dine. Foie gras with a blueberry sauce, Maine lobster with a butter lemon sauce, veal with lump crab meat and wild mushroom sauce, duck salad with orange vinaigrette, rack of lamb in thyme sauce. I know, lots of sauces, but it's French. And then for dessert, fruit, cheese, and two soufflés, chocolate and Grand Marnier. Then coffee and port. I savor it all as if it is my last meal on earth. We drive back home that night through the dark, dark Virginia countryside, darker than any night Los Angeles can deliver. I peer, a little drunk, through the trees at the large houses tucked away at the end of long, rolling driveways. Any one of them could be haunted. Tonight, they all are. And so am I. I'm 3,000 miles away from home, but my life has come with me. And I'm drifting closer to the due date when the baby arrives and my life becomes real in a way I'm simply not prepared for. Matt's movie, The Pallbearer, opens tomorrow night. I hope it is a huge success. I hope it is a total failure. What is wrong with me? A thought is forming in the dark. It's been forming for a while. It begins to take on the substance of words whispered from a dark subterranean cave, echoing with grim authority. You are stupid. You are a fool. You have fooled yourself, overextended yourself, and now you are the falcon lost in the widening gyre and the center cannot hold. Maybe today, maybe tomorrow, maybe next week, it all comes crashing down. I try to smother the words, banish the thought, the same way I have every day since the day I didn't sell Truth or Consequences. But really, shouldn't that have been the big warning sign? You're not ready to work on your own. No one wanted what you had to offer. They still don't. That is the truth, and these are the consequences. I've run as far as I can. There is nowhere left to run. Whatever the dream was that I had when I was in high school, maybe it was finally time to let it go. As we leave the countryside and re-enter the city, I see a large, brightly lit billboard with David Schwimmer's face crowded in next to Gwyneth Paltrow's. Because of course I do. When we arrive back at Claudia and Lee's house, there is a message on their answering machine, but it is not for Claudia or Lee. It's for me. It's David Saunders, my agent. He wants me to call him back. I'd given him this number, but I absolutely never expected him to actually use it. Did Warner Brothers change their mind? Did I actually sell Quentin's Loose? I consider not calling him. It's already 10:15. Then I realize in Los Angeles, it's only 7:15. So I give him a try and he picks up on the first ring. He's still at the office. He tells me, there's a book adaptation that a producer named Wayne Williams wants me to consider. The book is called Jupiter's Daughter by Tom Hyman. I feel a stab of disappointment. I've never heard of this guy or this book, and I'm not sure why it was so important that he called me all the way out here. He doesn't even sound particularly excited. I ask him if this is something I need to deal with right now, or can I wait until I get home? He says it's no big deal. He says it's under option at some company called Stephen J. Cannell Productions. Then he says, he's some big TV guy, or was in the 1980s, and the company's trying to branch out into feature films. My heart stops. Stephen J. Cannell? Did you say Stephen J. Cannell? Yeah, he says. Do you know him? Do I know him? Yeah, I know him. Then David says, well, he's really trying to get into the movies. Besides this Jupiter's Daughter thing, they're looking for someone to write a movie version of the A-Team. I feel my face go numb. and my hand loosens on the receiver. I sit down, hitting my hip hard on the kitchen table, but nothing's registering correctly. Stephen J. Cannell is looking for someone to write an A-Team movie? I'd kill my mom for a chance to write the A-Team movie, I say, with a complete lack of self-awareness or irony. David's surprised. I'm never excited about anything, but he's always happiest when he has something to do, so he assures me he'll get in touch with Wayne and we'll talk in a few days. I hang up the phone and then stand up, just staring at the linoleum on the floor of Claudia and Lee's kitchen. I turn and look out the window into the darkness of their backyard. I can't see anything but a blurry reflection of myself staring back. I'm still buzzing on booze and caffeine. Don't get your hopes up, I think. They want you to do this Jupiter book. And they probably already have someone lined up for the A-Team. Just try not to think about it.
Buffalo, New York, Holiday Inn. The ghost of a little girl who was burned to death in a house that once stood here now haunts the modern motel built over the ashes of her home. Guests, maids, managers, and the bellboys have all witnessed Tanya's playful spirit. People usually report her jumping on beds in empty rooms or running through the halls at night. Scott Swagler says, quote, "Our housekeepers have stories about Tanya that could fill a book," end quote.
An hour later, I'm in bed when the phone rings again. It's 11:30. Michelle and I are downstairs in Lee's basement office, which doubles as a guest room. Michelle is reading her book, and I'm writing in my journal. I don't answer the phone, of course. I don't live here. But a few seconds later, Claudia is at the top of the stairs calling down, "It's some guy named Wayne Williams. He wants to talk to you." What the fuck? I pick up the downstairs extension. It's Wayne Williams. He's the feature film development guy at Stephen J. Cannell Productions. He has a very wild, intense voice, and he's very excited, very excited. It turns out he's read Truth or Consequences, and he loves it. He just got off the phone with David Saunders, and he thinks I would be great for the A-Team movie. They just had someone else pitch for it, and it was a total disaster. Here's what he said to me on the phone that night. "Whoever we hire to write this movie has to have three things. They have to be on Universal's approved list, and you are. They have to have passion for the project, and you obviously do. And they have to have the preparation. Stephen told me today they have to come in and blow me away. That's where I come in. I'm going to make sure you have the preparation. You're going to blow him away. When do you get back from Washington?" I can't believe what I'm hearing. It's all too perfect. It's everything I want. Can this actually be happening? We talk for an hour, and by the time we hang up, it's like we've known each other for years. I look over at Michelle. Somehow, during all of this, she's fallen asleep. She is so pregnant now, she looks like she could give birth at any moment. But it's only May 1st. There's still plenty of time before July. I'm going to be a father. But that's okay too. Everything is okay because now I know what my first real job is going to be. It's going to be the A-Team movie. The universe was obviously waiting for this miraculous moment, for everything to align so I would be the one to get this call on this night. And it will all lead to me meeting up once again with my hero. 13 years later. But now, I'm not just some crazy high school kid. Now I'm a professional writer. Which means that this time, it's going to end differently. This time, I'm going to get the job. And it will save me. I just know it will. Because in a world where a young man's ghost haunts a Burger King in West Palm Beach, Florida, and the Virgin Mary makes monthly visits to a tiny farmhouse in Conyers, Georgia, how could anyone not believe in magic? Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Please join me next time for the National Directory of Haunted Places, Part 2. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.